This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You are listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar together with Wong Xiaoning and Philip C. It's 6 in the morning on Wednesday, the 23rd of March. Comrades, good morning.
Why comrades. The choice of the word comrades this morning, Shaz?
Oh, friends? You want to be called friends? Sure, I can call you friends. Colleagues?
How would you like to be referred to?
Colleagues, I feel very professional today. We have to be professional today,
Yes. Okay. It is the middle of the week, you know, so maybe we can call it, yeah, Professional Wednesday. No, that's a terrible
Oh, Embryo Friday.
No, we've put that to rest. But we do have a lot of stories lined up for you this morning. Beginning at 7:15, we're going to go down the curious path of discussing what it would take to legalize cryptocurrencies in the Malaysian context. And this comes on the back of comments by the Deputy Minister of Communication in Parliament, which suggested that, hey, maybe Bank Negara and the Securities Commission should look into doing this.
I find it curious that it's the Ministry of Communications that has suggested this. You're like, okay.
And Shaoning, you asked, right, whether Bank Negara was consulted in this process.
Well, it's everybody trying not to work in their silos, right? After all, 5G is being is looked after by now the Ministry of Finance through the DNB. So who knows, right?
A lot of overlap here and there. But we're going to be speaking to Aaron Tang of Luno on this. And what do we have after that?
Well, at 7:30, as we enter into the next quarter of 2022, the big question, what's the outlook for the global economy as we have inflationary risks, we have the war in Ukraine, those really pose a risk to what was generally a sense of optimism at the beginning of the year. So Julia Goh, the economist from UOB, is going to give us a little chat on this.
Because Shaoning, you know, the first 3 months was definitely not boring, was it?
When has life ever been boring, Philip? We live in this post-pandemic world.
Well, I'm sure those projections will change a lot. But at 7:45, you know, following the announcements of the amendments to the Employment Act, we will speak to lawyer Donovan Chia to get his perspective on the implications of these amendments. Because we had a discussion yesterday about the expansion of maternity leave, paternity leave, and also the provisions for flexible work arrangement. So getting his perspective on what all this means for all of us here.
We have all this and more on The Morning Run today, so stick with us, BFM 89.9. That was Buddy Miles with Dreams. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Shazana Mokhtar, Wong Xiaoning, and Philip C. Now, today, our first story looks at the World Happiness Report, which was issued on the 20th of March, I believe, which is actually World Happiness Day, for those who aren't in the know. It's actually the 10th edition this year. It's been going on for 10 years. And this report has been compiled by the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is a nonprofit organization under the United Nations. So every year, they conduct a survey in collaboration with Gallup, asking people to rate their sense of happiness or well-being within the country. And if you want to look at the rankings, Finland has come out on top this year. Again, this is actually the fifth time they've been ranked as number one in terms of happiness. Out of the 150 countries-ish, Malaysia comes somewhere in the middle. We're at 70th, along with most of our ASEAN peers. But Singapore is number 27. So they're like the top, they're in the top 30 of the ranking. So let's discuss this report today and what you guys think about it. How helpful is a world happiness ranking for countries?
Shall I start? Can I be the bugbear in the room, the Debbie Downer, about this happiness report?
The negative Nancy.
Yeah, okay, I'll be negative Nancy. It's the double N, since my name is Shaoning, so I've got the three N's anyway going for it. But yeah, Philip gave me this look. When I look at the foreword of this report, I have to say every academic involved comes from almost every academic comes from a Western organization. Everyone. So you've got University of British Columbia, you've got LSC, you've got Simon Fraser University, which I believe is in Canada. You've got a lot of University of Oxford. I don't see any Asians there. So I'm just curious, who defines this happiness? And is it then a very Western-centric definition? You know, because that's important.
And my point is, what's the point of this report, right? We've had 10 years of this. Has it instructed us in doing anything or making any changes?
Shine the light on a dark world. That's, I'm reading it from the forward, by the way.
Shine what, though? Because for me, it doesn't drive any actions per se. I mean, let's talk about country Bhutan. They have this gross national happiness target That's fine, right? They've decided that internally they want to do. But I wonder if ranking happiness is really relevant, because of all the 150 countries, 149 will not be happy with the results, isn't it? The only one will be happy will be Finland. Denmark and Norway,
maybe,
Sweden will not be happy as
maybe
well.
Maybe the top 10 will be happy, then the rest will be miserable.
They won't be happy as well, because Denmark, Norway is comparing themselves with Finland, and they're going to say, hey, why is Finland happier than I am?
Well, again, I feel like, to be honest, I think that they're not as they're probably not as affected as it by as the rest of us are, who are not ranked in the top 10 of happiness. But yes, I would agree. And I think we've all read this op-ed, this opinion piece by Noah Feldman in Bloomberg, where he was sort of griping about this, about the benefits of whether it's even helpful to be ranking countries by happiness, because essentially everybody has their own concept of happiness, right? This assumes that happiness is this, there's a common acceptable definition, but that's not really the case. And I do think that happiness is a misnomer when you look at this report in terms of how they measure the different measures within this report.
I mean, I think what typically people see is that there's a very strong correlation between this happiness survey versus the GDP per capita, which I don't think is necessarily the right correlation I hope to see, right? And I got a feeling that happiness actually comes from the progression and journey we take rather than the final outcome, you know, in that sense. So I don't know whether that also tracks that, right? The progress that we've made as society in respective societies as well. Because, you know, those that are bottom ranked, they're those basically war-torn countries. But those actually that have got out of war and actually moved forward, I think you will also see huge improvements in happiness levels as well.
Well, I'm looking at the data itself, right? What are the criteria in which they rank this World Happiness Report? So like you say, Philip, there's low GDP per capita, there's social support, there's healthy life expectancy at birth, there's freedom to make life choices, generosity. I wonder what is the definition of generosity though? Perceptions of corruption and positive effect. Then there's negative effect. So it's quite objective in a way, but at the same time, it doesn't actually take into account what the many subjective elements of happiness itself, right?
Yeah, I feel happiness is more subjective than objective, isn't it? When you try and put it through a quantitative measure, it gets very hard because a lot of it is emotionally driven. And so when you start putting numbers to it, I think you're just going down a very, very, very wrong path.
Well, my only issue with this report is really the title happiness. I don't think it should be called the happiness report. But if you want to measure, I suppose, the level of support that a person has in a country, then I think it is a very good measure. I had a really interesting conversation with the ambassador of Finland to Malaysia last week on the Breakfast Grill. And I asked him about this, you know, why does Finland rank so highly on this report? And he mentioned something about just the trust that exists between the government and the public, as well as vice versa. You know, there's a mutual trust where both sides accept that they will do what's best for each other in a weird way. I think it's a little bit antithetical to what we are experiencing here, because there's a lot of public mistrust against politicians and government at times.
Think, you know, when you look at this, maybe standard of life rather than happiness.
And yes. I was speaking to friends who live in Finland, and they say, yeah, it's not happiness per se, but it's this this feeling of safety that if something were to happen to them, if they were to lose their jobs, if they were to fall sick, they have a safety net. They have something that can back them up. They know they're not going to be destitute. They're not going to fall into poverty. They're not going to end up homeless living under a bridge. So having that safety net really helps with the contentedness. And when you think about it, having those safety nets also enable you to make decisions for your life. So that's kind of the relation between a good public institutional network and, I suppose, happiness, if you want to put it that way.
Peace of mind and contentedness. I think those are better ways of maybe articulating this rather than the word HAPPY.
Well, tell us what you think. You know, have you taken a look at the World Happiness Report? What do you think makes a country happy? Is this even helpful to be looking, to be ranking countries according to happiness? You can WhatsApp us at 01-8789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We're taking a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be discussing the impact of refugee flows on neighboring countries. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Charles Bradley with Ain't It a Sin. If that doesn't rise you out of bed, I don't know what will. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana Shaoning and Philip. Now, the war in Ukraine has spotlighted the issue of refugees in a way that prior conflicts haven't quite done before, not in the same way. And especially for a European audience, I think a lot more Europeans and the Western countries are really paying close attention to what's happening to refugees coming out of Ukraine. As we know, to date, over 3 million refugees have fled the country and close to 7 million Ukrainians have been displaced internally. And there's been a lot of coverage on the refugee situation. Phil, you have a suggested reading reading experience or something. You suggest listening to a podcast by The Journal on this.
Yes. I listened to this over the weekend and I love the podcast because it highlights the really delicate balance that these neighboring countries have to contend with, right, with the Russia-Ukraine war. As you said, right, Charles, there are 7 million Ukrainians displaced internally, 3 million refugees have fled the country, and two-thirds of those actually arrived at Poland. You know, so we've seen a lot of pictures about how actually these neighboring countries have been so warm and welcoming. It has been really heartwarming to see that neighbors have been very much welcoming, right, offering a lot of help and support across the board. But when you go and see the underlying issues, there is really delicate balance that these governments have to strike, right, between providing the necessary support there versus perhaps, you know, making sure that their current citizens' needs are still met, you know. So listening to the podcast, I was just struck by how difficult not only Ukraine has to deal with, but also how the neighboring countries are also having to contend with this crisis as well.
We had a similar discussion on this earlier in the week, Yumi and Chen Li Shan, remember, where we talked about immigration policy and the and how governments maybe should look at strengthening institutions in order to facilitate a better immigration policy. And refugees, no doubt, are part of that picture, especially in situations like this where you suddenly have a war and you have all these people needing a safe place to flee to. Like you said, the podcast really does show you how much strain it puts on education, because if refugees come in, will the children that come in also be enrolled in schools? Do you have enough housing to house them all, especially for the long term, if the war goes on, you know, longer than anyone expects? So a lot of these issues come into play.
Yeah, I think for sure, kudos to the Polish people, because they've been very welcoming and there's a lot of goodwill. But of course, I don't want to be the cynic, but how long is this goodwill going to last? Because the war doesn't look like it's ending. It's almost coming to a month. And just to highlight a point, even in the city of Warsaw, there's already 300,000 Ukrainian refugees at the current moment. And apparently, one of the biggest issues has been schools, because in Ukraine, they have allowed women, children, and the elderly to leave the country. So basically, they have been the bulk of the refugees. So Poland has allowed these children to register in schools. But there's this apparently enormous language barrier, and these children are also extremely traumatized by what they saw when they left. And I wonder, the school system, can it really absorb? So let's just take this conversation back home to Malaysia. Imagine 300,000 people, you know, suddenly turning up in Kuala Lumpur and suddenly attending all our schools. We would also struggle to cope, right? And if, let's say, they didn't speak Bahasa Malaysia or they didn't speak English, how are we going to communicate with them? How are we going to assimilate with them? And then there's always going to be questions like, how long are these people going to be here? The negative thoughts will start coming in, right? So I mean, I think those are the real practical challenges.
I mean, we already have that issue, yeah? I mean, one of the glaring deficiencies in my view, in our immigration policy is the fact that we're not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. We don't recognize refugees.
So we don't allow refugee children access to our health, our education system, which is, to me, very alarming.
They're not given these rights in our country, although we do provide assistance and we do give them access to UNHCR services, for example. But again, we are not very kind to refugees that come to our country. So I personally feel that this needs to change. But again, I do agree that it all also depends on having the public institutions to be able to prop that up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think about the camps, right, we have here for Myanmar refugees and Rohingya. That's the problem we have. Now, if you look at the story here in Poland, it's a very fine balance. So, for example, for the Ukrainian refugees, they give them like access to public transport with, you know, subsidized cards, similar to what a normal Polish citizen have. But they restrict them access to car park lots, because if they give too many car park lots available to all these Polish Ukrainian refugees, then what do the Polish citizens do? So that's a very delicate balance on a more micro level, right, in the city of Warsaw.
Absolutely. And we don't have time to cover this at length, but don't forget that there are also just these concerning, I suppose, those allegations of just the different way refugees are treated depending on where they come from. You know, have all these refugees been really given the same warm welcome? Absolutely not. And I think going into that will require a longer conversation. But tell us what you think. You know, what do you think should be in place for a good refugee policy? How long do you think the goodwill can last? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We're heading into the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin now. And when we come back, we'll take a look at headlines from around the world. So stay with us, BFM 89.9. That was Green Day with Warning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Shazana, Xiaoning and Philip. It is Wednesday, the 23rd of March. Midweek hump day, however you want to call it. And it's that time of the day when we take a look at what's making headlines from around the world. Phil, I'm going to have you start. What's the headline that's caught your eye this morning?
Well, I think we must still maintain our focus on the Russia-Ukraine crisis, but I want to take a bit of a different angle now. There is this concern that the Russia's war in Ukraine might hasten the arrival of SplinterNet, right? A forced division of cyberspace under the control of competing political blocs. That's according to France's digital affairs envoy, Henri Verdier. Now, what he's saying is that Russia is accelerating domestic online censorship. Ukraine is now calling for Russia to be taken online. And what this could precipitate is a whole series of multiple internets, right? Basically, different digital domains out there which don't connect to each other, essentially. And that's a bit worrying because you can drive and, you know, create all these like cyber attacks between these different internets. But what happens later if they try and attack each other internally as well? That's a bit of the concern.
Wow, I have actually never heard that term SplinterNet. So that's something new that I've learned today. And it's true that the online world is... it's being described by many observers as another front for the war, essentially, both in terms of social media information or disinformation, and then also from the cybersecurity angle, as you've pointed out, Phil. So lots of different dimensions to the current conflict going on.
Yeah, so much so that I think Joe Biden has mentioned it many times in the U.S. that the U.S. should really bolster its defenses when it comes to cybersecurity. Because the war takes place no longer just on the battleground, but clearly on the internet. But at the same time, what you say, Phil, worries me a little bit. Because if you have disparate, two separate internet systems in a way, then you make it very difficult to actually allow people, in Russia, for example, to find out what's really happening in the outside world, right? Then the ability to control the propaganda becomes even stronger.
I mean, we've seen that happening in China, right?
With the great firewall.
So will more countries resort to this? It's something that is being closely monitored.
What people do is, of course, they have another VPN address. But I don't know whether this takes it to another level where you can't even use another VPN address.
I mean, this is the problem, right? Everyone desires control. And they think they can control the internet. And what happens is that it's so hard to get around that. I think people just have to accept the reality that you will just have to, you know, go through the dark web, and it's easy to basically escape it. So I think this whole pursuit for control, I think, is basically will come to nothing in my view.
All right. Well, something we're going to keep an eye on for sure. What else has caught your eye? How about you, Xiaoning? What's the headline that's caught your attention?
Well, I'm going to refer to that very sad incident that happened 2 days ago, which is the China Eastern Airlines jet that crashed on Monday. So far, what they found out is that it was traveling, and this is according to Bloomberg, it was traveling at close to the speed of sound in the moments before it slammed into a hillside. So such an impact may actually complicate the task for investigators because it basically will just smash up any little bits of evidence, and in rare cases, it can even damage the plane's data and voice recorders.
And I think they've been rescuers or investigators have been hampered by weather at this point. It's just been hard to access the site. It's been hard to retrieve bodies, and it's such a tragic incident to have happened in this time.
Yeah, and I think this incident has also created a lot of concern among passengers traveling around China. According to Bloomberg, 74% of the 11,800 flights scheduled in China on Tuesday have been cancelled, right? And that includes the majority due between Beijing and Shanghai, so one of the busiest routes. So actually for China, if you look at it, the domestic travel market has kind of held up quite well throughout the pandemic, but this crash has really dented confidence substantially. So we saw that based on what we saw yesterday, 74% of scheduled flights got cancelled.
That's one of the repercussions of what happens in these tragic disasters. Let's still stick to the area of China, although not, well, China, yes. We're going to take a look at Hong Kong and some of the headlines coming out of there. I think authorities in Hong Kong have given indication that they're actually going to start lifting restrictions on travelers. They'll be allowing transit passengers at the airports for the first time in 3 months, beginning April 1st. And I think they are trying to rebuild confidence among the business community that Hong Kong is still a viable place to do business. But it has definitely been dented by the high infection rates of COVID-19, as well as just the difficult rules in place that make it so hard to for people to live and just do business there.
Is it a little bit too little, too late?
It's something to ask indeed. Chief Executive Carrie Lam is due to end her term sometime this year. Whether she's going to be renewed for a second term is something that everyone's watching. By the looks of it, I'm not sure. She's not ending her term on a good note on this. 6:46 in the morning, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at what's making headlines in our local newspapers and portals. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. That was Paul McCartney with Jet. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar with Wang Xiaoning and Philip C. Now it's that time of day where we take a look at what's making the front pages of our newspapers and portals. Xiaoning, why don't you start us off with what you see?
Okay, I'm looking at the nine New Straits Times on page 6. And the headline is Table Act or We'll Take to the Streets, warns Mat Sabu. So the opposition has issued a final warning to the government to table and pass the anti-hopping law at the current parliament session, or it will take to the streets, according to Mat Sabu, because he says that the government, I like this quote, he says, this is because when we are in parliament, we are sometimes not heard. Maybe they, the government, want thousands of people to be on the streets like the last time. Only then they will listen to the voices of the people. Please do not toy with this act. There is a pressing need for this.
I think that's all. That's also the headline of Utusan Malaysia, actually. They have got a small headline here. MOU terbatal jika tidak bentang esok. Referring to that MOU between the government and Pakatan Harapan, where tabling an anti-helping law was one of the conditions within that MOU for this, you know, truce between the two sides. So what's going to happen if this bill isn't tabled? I think the minister has mentioned that they are not tabling it yet because of issues that still need to be ironed out.
They want to talk to some of the other stakeholders, right, which I believe are BN and actually the PN.
So does the opposition want to cancel the MOU? That's the big question. So, you know, we've had this whole conversation, as you were saying, right, you know, DAP, Anthony Lok, saying that they're proposing a second phase of the MOU instead. So I don't know whether there's disunity among opposition about this whole position as well with respect to the MOU.
I mean, if we look at it, the MOU is supposed to run until the end of July, correct?
Yeah.
The idea was that the opposition wouldn't try to call for a general election until the end of July. The next parliamentary sitting is actually only scheduled for July, for mid-July, 18th of July. So tomorrow is supposed to be the last day of this parliamentary sitting. Parliament will only convene again in July. I don't know. Will that be the timeline for them to table this bill or not? I mean, I think this is something that's still very fluid and something we'll be watching for sure.
Yeah. Other news, I think, of course, is on page 6 as well. And this is the PAC to look into the AG report findings. So parliamentary watchdog alarmed with hundreds of millions of ringgit in
irregular.
Yes. This morning has been an extreme tongue twister.
I was wondering
me.
What you're going to say. Iridescent?
Sorry. My bad.
Irregular.
Irregular. So among the issues are the failure of the Armed Forces Superannuation Fund to return the government's contributions worth close to 700 million to the QAP, apart from irregular dividend payments. Wow.
I mean, the AG's, not the Attorney General, Auditor General's report is a minefield of these kinds of cases. And it's good that we have this watchdog to monitor all these projects. But again, the question that always seems to come is, why do these keep happening?
And hardly anyone is brought to task for the fact that these incidences actually happen. I've never heard of anyone really being sacked. yes. or being put to prison if there's any criminal conduct. Nothing, right? So far, we've never heard anything.
You're right. It really all boils down to governance, isn't it? You know, it's not really the action per se, but it's how the decision-making process was done and the governance for many of these institutions across the organization. Can I just bring our attention to a very light article on the Edge, page 4, with the COVID cases. Now, Kyrie, our Minister of Health, said they've issued a compound to Lim Kit Siang. That's the headline, right? But if you read the details, he then shared the posting as a response to Pekan MP Datuk Sri Najib Tun Razak. And he said, the compound has been sent to Lim Kit Siang. MOH hopes that Najib Razak will pay up one compound issued during the Johor state election, which has not yet been settled. MOH also hopes Najib Razak has received four other compounds sent by a registered post, which his officers refused to accept earlier. So I think the headline is a bit misleading, that yes, there was an issued compound, but I think the real perpetrator here was the former Prime Minister himself.
So it's touche to MLH jabbing one of our Pekan MP Najib Razak on this. Interesting stuff. Another headline that I just want to draw to your attention is Think Tank Red Flags Amendments to Employment Act. And we're going to be discussing this a little bit later on the show at 7:45. Just how the Employment Act amendments, how are they actually going to be implemented? Because I think one glaring feature is that the amendments would only apply to those earning under 2,000 ringgit, if I'm not mistaken. So that makes me scratch my head. Like, what? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. So
it should be applicable to everybody, right?
Exactly.
Regardless of how much you earn.
Like, why is that a criteria in this?
Yeah, and can I just say, if you're going to increase minimum wage to 1,500, that band of impacted people is very small. And my take is, actually, if you widen the these kind of terms for those under 2,000, is it career limiting for those under 2,000 to actually progress onwards? Don't you need to create a level playing field then?
So a lot of questions. We're going to post this to lawyer Donovan Chia. Maybe he'll be able to give us some enlightenment on what this all actually means. 6:57 in the morning. We're now heading into the 7 a.m. news bulletin. And when we come back, a look at global markets. Taking you to the news is Florence and the Machine with You've Got the Love. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.